The following content is provided under a Creative Commons license. Your support will help MIT OpenCourseWare continue to offer high-quality educational resources for free. To make a donation or view additional materials from hundreds of MIT courses, visit MIT OpenCourseWare at ocw.mit.edu.
I'd like to introduce Jesper. Jesper Juhl is an old friend of the lab and currently at the Royal Danish
Academy. It's actually longer than this. It's the Royal Danish Academy of Fine Arts Schools of Architecture, Conservation and Design, comma, School of Design.
Right. and you've also taught at NYU.
Yeah.
You're a visiting professor here, and you've been a game scholar for, is it a decade now?
Maybe more than a decade.
Okay. If you take a bunch of the classes here, we sometimes have readings from Jesper or articles that he's written. This is another example of the talks that we've been having on. You know, this is what people do once they understand game design, right? Some people study games.
Yes.
Some people do research and write books about it. And ask interesting questions and try to find out more about what makes games fascinating or what makes the environment in which we create games or we play games interesting. So with that, I'd like to hand it over to Jesper.
Right.
This is Game Design 608.
Hello, Game Design 608. Are you doing digital games or analog games or?
Only analog.
All right. Yeah. So I think I'll mostly be talking probably mostly about digital games right now. But I think it probably applies to some extent. So Philip introduced me so nicely. So this is really a part of a conference presentation I did earlier in April. And so if you're interested in reading the full paper, it's on my website at this kind of URL independent style. So, and if you just go to /text, you can see some of the other stuff I've written. I've also written a few books actually about video games. So I wrote one about, you can call it kind of video games and storytelling, and one about casual games. And my most recent one, called The Art of Failure, is in a way about being a sore loser. So it's called an essay on the pain of playing video games. So that's a book on this question of why we claim we enjoy video games, even though if you look at people playing, they often look quite unhappy, actually. So it's a discussion on that. But this one is a discussion of slightly kind of different things, a different thing, the question of independent games. I think there seems to be a kind of consensus that independent games have become a kind of important aspect of game culture. And you can see this in several ways. Both, here's the cheap, very cheap kind of Google n-gram way of showing that something is popular. I don't know if anybody knows why it's never flat, this curve. Does somebody know? So it's an economic game theory. There's actually a concept called independent game. So it means like a game that's not attached to other games. So that's why it's never quite flat, the curve. But certainly it shows you that like from 2000 on, people started talking about independent games. And you can also see that, say, Sony and Microsoft actually spend a good deal of energy at least to claim how independent game friendly they are with their new consoles. So this is the thing. And we can talk about this, probably a few different reasons why we're talking about independent games, and one of them may be that budgets have become too big in AAA development, so there's this kind of opening for games made on a smaller budget. And also that it's become easier to distribute games. So it used to be you could only distribute a game on a disc and in a box, and that's no longer true, fortunately. And this means it's become possible to make kind of games in different sizes. And then also finally, there's this thing that, can sound kind of weird, that in a way, the independent games, in a way, presuppose the idea of independent games. So let me explain what that means. So it's that if you're making a game on a small budget, one of the things you need to be able to be sure of is that people who see your game don't just think of it as a game with too small a budget. Right, that they actually understand that this is a game that actually has some positive qualities to it, or that there's a particular reason why it has a small budget, or the fact that a bigger budget wouldn't have made this game any better. And so I think the idea of the independent game is actually, it's really that idea that you can actually say, I'm making an independent game, and people will understand that this is a game that has a particular set of qualities, where it's a feature, the fact that it's a game with a small budget. And so it also means, you can see the question is like, what makes people assume that something is an independent game when they see it, right? I don't think it's just that it says independent game somewhere, but I do think there's actually a particular style that's common to independent games. I'll talk about that a bit. But first you can see that when people write about independent games, actually the first thing that everybody will say is that you can't define independent games. This is kind of the first thing you have to say. And so there are all these kind of people say that you can't define it because this creates discord in the game community. Or Eric Zimmerman talks about independent in different kind of ways, economic, technological, or cultural status. And then there are several people who say, well, there's no point in trying to define independent games in the first place. So I think that's actually been said a lot. On the other hand, if you look at what people who make independent games say, there's actually a lot of things in common. So Dan Cook talks about that independent games allow you to be a fan of someone who's authentic and deserving. Edmund Macmillan actually talks about honesty and speaking from your heart. He made a Super Meat Boy. And Dan Cook made Triple Time, if you play that. And Robin Arnott talks about more personal relationship with the work for independent games. John Sharp has a whole discussion comparing independent games to punk music, like the emphasis on the kind of small kind of personal, anyone can do it kind of thing. And Anthropy has talked about kind of these smaller budgets allowing games to be more personal and more relevant. And so I think these are quite similar in some ways, right? So they talk about this kind of the honest and the personal and what they call this minimal complexity. You can understand who made the game. And a bit like we talked about just before with Kickstarter, right? That if you buy a AAA game, it's not necessarily clear who actually made the game. And with independent games, I think there's much more of an idea that you will have a feeling of the author's or the creator's personality. All right, and so you can see that these are also what I call kind of moral and aesthetic claims. So at the same time, so it's not just, you can see it's not just saying that these are better games. It's a bit more deep than that, right? It's also saying in a way that this is a better way of making a game. So not just that it'll be a better product, but that even say like the quality of life of someone who makes an indie game will be better, but also in a way that we'll all be better off if more people make independent games, because we'll have more kind of communication and more ideas being spread and more diversity and so on. Now, so the thing is, this is not exactly new. So this is a, I don't know, this is called the Trellis Wallpaper by William Morris and Philip Webb from 1862. So I think one of the things that strikes me with indie is that it actually is quite similar to some things that have happened several times, but I think particularly happened with the idea of what was called the arts and crafts movement of the 19th century. So you can see when we talk about independent games, I do think it ties into several things, such as like the idea of DIY or the maker movement, or the idea of kind of local food production, like the locavore movement. This idea that if you go to a restaurant, you should know where the chicken you ate actually came from. So actually only yesterday I was at this restaurant called Evo. I don't know if anyone has been to it. And it actually lists on the left side of the menu like all of the farms from where they get their ingredients. And it has this kind of like, wow, isn't that amazing? And of course I've never heard of any of those farms. I have no idea where they are, but it kind of still works for me that this kind of sense that you kind of understand that there's this kind of honesty or something authentic about it. Right, but the arts and crafts movement, I think, typically discussed as being this like late 19th century movement where people reacted against industrialization and kind of machine production, and they felt that this included a kind of loss of quality or personality, so that you didn't even know who made the product and the products themselves would be kind of worse. And then so John Ruskin kind of, he talks about, he has this kind of idea that in medieval times, he's fascinated by the idea of the medieval guild, this kind of small group of people making something like a Gothic building. And William Morris talks about this idea that of handicraft or the craftsperson making something that's kind of much better than what would be made by machine production. And again, not just that it would be better products, but then in a way like society at large, the world would be a better place if we made things that way. And I do think you can say that I think it's very clear with the idea of independent games, it's kind of similar in the sense that when they talked about the revival of, say, craftsmanship and handicraft, it's a reaction against this kind of big machine or big corporate productions or mass production. And I think very similar, you can say that independent games are a reaction against like very large AAA production teams. And so they have this idea that we should return to these kind of smaller productions, and this will make everything kind of better on a number of levels. Does that make sense? Do you have strong feelings about independent games
who has an independent game that you enjoy playing or have enjoyed playing?
I enjoy particularly Limbo. I think independent games now have more freedom to explore different mechanics and sort of step away from what sells, and because they don't have a million dollar investments that they have to make sure sells, so they don't have to do what is proven to do well in the market. So they have more freedom that way. So I like playing games because they take more risks.
So I found that just for me personally, I don't really play games unless I'm planning on playing them a lot. So I play competitively League of Legends or Super Smash Brothers. And so one of the problems I have with independent games is that I don't feel like they're as developed. They're generally on the more creative side, which is definitely something appreciable, but not something that I enjoy. I prefer getting very, very good at mechanics and such.
Yeah, I guess especially the multiplayer aspect is not necessarily that developed. I mean, there's this new collection out called Sports Friends. Does anybody play that?
But we played Joust.
Yeah,
all right. So that's one of the four games of Sports Friends.
You can get really good
checks. Yeah, no. So it's true. It's not in the way that the kind of competitive sports is not that developed. And it's a game called Meat Hawk, if you've seen that, which has a bit of it, right? But yeah. I mean, that's kind of part of that kind of complex. Yeah.
So kind of on the opposite note, I think not all, but a lot of independent games have an ability to just be harder.
Yes.
In single player mode, while the competitive aspect might not be there, because mass multiplayer is very difficult to do, they can be harder in single player mode because they don't need to remake the investment stuff. Mm. So a lot of people are frustrated when they lose, but they kind of explore that more readily.
And I do think it's also, in a way, the sense that you can also see with these people here, there's a kind of nostalgia, right, for an earlier time. And I do think that it's also part of this kind of question of difficulty. It's also part of that, this sense that all of the edges are being kind of removed or the challenges being removed from kind of big game productions to please everybody, rather than if you make an indie game, you can make something that's more kind of tight and more kind of focused and have things like extreme difficulty. I think that's certainly an argument that people make.
Actually, I have a question. Yeah. Does anybody remember the phrase Nintendo hard?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, because that's not what Nintendo is anymore, right? Mm-hmm. Right.
Yes, exactly.
But on the flip side to that point, aren't you sort of breaking the number one design rule, which is accessibility?
Yes.
When you make games incredibly difficult, such that you're carving out a very small niche audience and just saying screw you to everybody else, and that's
But I think this also we'll get to this a bit. That in a way the arts and crafts movement also had this kind of political thing that it would be for everybody, or like art by the people for the people. But the standard criticism is that it kind of ended up making kind of conspicuous consumption for rich people. And you see the same thing like with the local food movement. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's usually pretty expensive actually. And so it's something that kind of happens that in a way you can often have these kind of ideals of broadening things via this kind of production method, but often in a way you can also there can be this kind of flip side of actually narrowing it, making these kind of lead objects or objects for it. But let's discuss this in a moment. But the question is there one thing that I thought was interesting was to ask if there is anything kind of common in the way, just talking about the visual style of independent games. And here are three games that we often, I think, talk of as being independent, VVV, which has this kind of pixelated or large pixel style, and yet it moves as this kind of torn paper, and crayon physics has, well, obviously kind of children's drawings with crayons. And so you can say on one hand, these are kind of different graphical styles, but actually you can see what they do have in common is what you can call a kind of a double layer, right? It's a representation of a representation. Right, so the UV kind of represents like 1980s size pixels, which then represent the game world. And yet it moves with percents paper, which then represents a game world. And crayon physics represents crayons, which then represent a game world. And you can compare this to like if you play a kind of modern AAA game, you don't really have that. You have like 3D graphics which represent the game world. So I think what you can say that, I think that's, it's pretty common. I'm not saying this is not a definition of independent games. I'm just saying that I think when we usually see a game and recognize it as being an independent game, I think it's often because they will have this type of style, like a representation of representation. So often you'll use something, well, contemporary technology, obviously, but use that to emulate something that's kind of low tech and cheap, right? So you can see that. You can compare this to certain casual games like or matching games which might like sort of signal like jewels or diamonds or so on. But I think it's very clear that most kind of independent games tend to emulate these kind of very cheap materials like torn paper and things like that. I think also that the reason why people do this is that in a way what's done is that you're signaling that we have made a deliberate choice to have this style, and we have deliberately chosen to make a game on a small budget. And I think this is what this kind of style signals, and it also signals this thing of these things are talked about like authenticity or knowing who made the game or a kind of transparency in the kind of production process. And so you can think of it like this, right? That indie, at least in this sense, seems to mean three different things. Indie, like on paper, means like a financially independent team. Then I think there's also, you can see that these people who talked about indie from the game development community talked about it in a way that it was kind of morally and politically and aesthetically better. Not just better games, but also in a way better for everybody when games are made this way, because we can communicate values and ideas and so on. And then indie is a particular kind of style. And I think then this kind of style of having this kind of representation of a representation is one that people use to signal, now we're making a game with a small team and it has these kind of positive values of being kind of authentic and being something that where you can figure out what's going on you know, who made it. I'll just show you quickly how that kind of style appeared, I think. And so this is looking at the, Do you know in the Independent Games Festival? Do you follow this? So not so much. So anyways, this is at the Game Developers Conference every year since 2000. There's been this Independent Games Festival, and this is like the longest running festival of independent games. And this is kind of a jury based competition. And so one of the things that's interesting, I think, is looking at the winners of the grand prize in this Independent Games Festival. And one of the things that's kind of odd is that if you look at the first 5 years, none of the games, I think, actually signal independent very well in a kind of contemporary way. So you can see that the three of them are kind of somewhat regular games of armed conflict. And then Wild Earth is a kind of Pokemon Snap style game. And Bad Milk is this kind of weird, never released kind of associational CD-ROM. You click on things, and then other things appear, and so on. It never actually came out. But you can see that this, in a way, seems like from a different time. Like if you see like the picture of the, say, like the two top games, there's nothing on them, I think, that signals independent game in a kind of modern sense. And I think part of this is probably just because at this time, online distribution just wasn't that big a deal. And so when people submitted to a festival like this, what they did was sometimes probably just that they hoped that they would get noticed by a publisher who could then fund them so they could make a very big version of the game, which could then be shipped on a disc. And then we see that like from 2005 on, the winners of this festival gradually get more of this style I'm talking about. You see the kind of paradigmatic, like the kind of 2D platformer with some kind of twist in Gish. Then with Darwinia we see a kind of low poly style that today I think people kind of refers a bit to a movie like Tron. And then we see various takes on like watercolors and the kind of hand drawn graphics. And you see this actually coincides with the kind of gradual rise of digital distribution. So first in things like downloadable casual games, that this becomes possible, and also with flash game sites, that it becomes more possible to actually distribute a game without having it put in a box. And then more recently, then we see we still have this kind of pixel style, but then that gets kind of merged with different things. Like in a game like Monaco, it has these various lighting effects, and then in Minecraft and Fez, it gets moved into a kind of into the third dimension. So not that. And this is what I call, you can call it kind of counterfactual nostalgia, right? So in a way, it's pixelated as if there was a time in the 1980s when people would make 3D games with big pixels. Like this never happened, obviously, right? But in a way, it has this kind of steampunk anachronism about it, right? But still, you can see it kind of signals that this is a particular game, and then a particular style, and then they use kind of modern effects on it. And then the last 2 years still have this kind of flat, mostly grayscale pixel style now, but then there's certain things that seem to be happening in the gameplay where card life simulates the life of a poor card vendor, and Paper Please simulates being like an immigration officer. And so I think it also coincides with some people talk about the kind of moral turn. Like there's a lot of discussion about representation in various ways in games, and certainly a lot of emphasis on trying to make games with more kind of serious themes, so that cover a kind of broader range of themes. So I think this kind of shows you where this kind of style comes from, the representation of the representation. And you can also see that basically actually every single winner since 2005 of this festival has actually had this style, this kind of representation of the representation style. All right. But what does it mean? Well, I think there are a few kind of contradictions in independent games. And so one of them has to do with what you call like the DIY movement, this idea that anybody can make a video game now with independent games, versus the idea of independent games as being a kind of way for people to do games that are particularly expertly crafted. And some developers like Terry Cavanaugh actually talks about how it's easier for him to make a game with this kind of pixel style, I think because he doesn't consider himself that great a graphic artist, and so in a way that this kind of pixel style is easier for him to do, to make in a kind of convincing way. On the other hand, if you want to make a game like that in a tool like Unity 3D, by default Unity 3D kind of doesn't want you to do that. So by default Unity 3D will do these various filtering things on your texture. So if you just draw something with big pixels, it'll be very blurry, like on the image on the left. So you have to do various things of changing the settings in the rendering of Unity 3D to actually do pixel style. because that's not really what the tool is meant for doing anyway. And so this gives you a developer the possibility of kind of demonstrating technical expertise, right? You're working against the intentions of the tool, and that is a kind of feature. And so I think this is something that's a kind of conflict in independent games between that, like making independent games being these kind of very small games in which a developer has the opportunity to show off how great they are at various technical skills and at balancing all these like very small systems, versus independent games as being something where that kind of is open to everybody. And so you can take a designer like Anna Entropy, who wrote a book called Rise of the Video Game Seamstress, how freaks, normals, amateurs, artists, dreamers, dropouts, queers, housewives, and people like you are taking back an art form. Right, so it's about like making game development more democratic. And at the same time, when you see Anna Entropy's games, she's actually a very, very good designer. So she really makes these kind of games that are very, she's good at combining elements from game history and to use them in a new way. A second contradiction, I think, is more on the kind of use end, right? That on one hand, this idea of independent games tend to have this idea of this kind of the democratization, right? It becomes games by the people, for the people. On the other hand, I think also that you can see that now that it's so common to play video games, and more than 50% of the population actually plays video games on a regular basis, then I think also, to some extent, indie games can be this kind of way of showing that you have a more sophisticated taste than the kind of great masses, right? That if everybody plays Candy Crush, then you can show that you're playing some obscure game from the humble bundle that sort of regular people don't really learn to appreciate. And then it becomes more of this kind of fine kind of wine tasting issue. And so I think that suddenly you do have kind of breakout indie games like Minecraft, obviously, which of course is a very, very broad hit across like in a lot of countries. I don't mean it sold what 15 million copies or something, right?
Yeah.
It's
mind-blowingly
large. And then of course still the developer Notch, he still has this kind of scruffy look to him. So. Yeah, I had a discussion with someone the other day. Perhaps he has a stylist to make him look scruffy, so he kind of keeps his indie credibility. It could be.
Well, he's a fedora too.
Yes, yeah. But you can see this is a kind of ongoing conflict within independent games, right? This whether it's something that's supposed to be kind of very broad, or whether it's kind of a connoisseur thing, really. And I should say this, do you think that this you could actually see this as a result of that fact that so many people are playing video games, right? So it used to be that you could say the fact that you played video games made you belong into a particular category of people, right? But now that video game playing is so common, people need to select like a certain subset of video games to in a way have an identity as video game players. And then I think this kind of indie games can be seen as a kind of response to that. It's something. Yeah, it allows you to kind of feel that you have a particular taste. Right? Yeah, so I call this the authenticity. There's this guy called Richard Peterson who talks about the idea of the authenticity work. So one of the things he studied is country music, and he looks at how people argue and for various types of country music as being authentic in different ways. So it can be authentic in terms of like who recorded it, or in terms of style, or various things like that. And so he says that authenticity work is whenever people try to put in effort in order to make something appear authentic. So it's a bit like the restaurant, right, that they actually spend energy listing all of the places from where they got their ingredients, so to make the whole kind of menu appear more kind of authentic and local and so on. A kind of critical, this is particular kind of critical argument against it, saying that you see like this, to be experienced as authentic, something must be marked as authentic, and this makes it inauthentic, right, because it's something that's been done deliberate. And you can certainly see, like, in all kinds of products, obviously, where you can see there's some kind of advertising agency has spent a large amount of time trying to figure out how to make that particular thing look authentic by choosing the right fonts or colors or making it appear like an old country store or something, even though it's a big multi-billion dollar corporation and so on. And so you can see this in a way you can think of this would be a kind of critical idea of this would be a kind of critical thing you can say about independent games, that of course you don't necessarily have to make games with this particular style, right? And then that perhaps in a way it's, there's something kind of inauthentic about choosing a kind of style to seem authentic, right? And so that you can, so, but I think it's also a bit more complicated like that, right? Because in a way, just the fact that it's possible to make a game have or choose this particular style, both actually, that style is both interesting because it's actually cheap, it is fairly cheap to make games with like large pixels or scanned paper or things like that. And so even though you can say it's something that people sort of deliberately choose, and so it's not authentic in that sense, but it's still something that enables cheap game development, right? So it does solve that particular problem of how do you make a game on a small budget and make it appear as a deliberate choice rather than just a game with too small a budget. And so you can see that this is what that particular style does. I just say that there are a few games that we tend to talk of as independent which don't necessarily match this style. So Braid is a particularly interesting case because it does have this kind of representation of a representation style, right? It looks as a, it's made to look as a painting, but in a particular way, it's not meant to look as somebody's kind of offhand improvised painting or drawing. It's actually meant to look a bit like fine art. And so you see, in a way, it has this thing of being a representation of representation, but here it's actually supposed to signal that this is something like fine and nice or sophisticated. And I think this kind of matches here. Did you guys play Braid, or have you played Braid or discussed it? Right, so Braid is meant to be a kind of work of art with a capital A. And I do think this is why that particular style was chosen. I think it's a bit simplistic in that sense.